welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm Steve Wright from SCD Lifestyle, and we're live from AHS 2012. With me is Chris Kresser. How you doing, man?
Good. How are you, Steve? We're coming to you live, actually, from the Kraken Cave. We're in Matt LaLonde's office in the chemistry department here at Harvard University. It's pretty exciting. This is where all the magic happens.
This is where the Kraken Nutrient Density Scale was born, right here on this desk.
Right here, which we'll come back to in a second. But we thought it would be fun just to record a little informal show here with some of our impressions from AHS. If I can continue to talk for this show, as you can hear, my voice is a little scratchy. I just did my talk, and hopefully we'll be able to finish the show.
Yeah, if you guys aren't here, Chris rocked the mic for 40 minutes plus and had questions for probably a couple hours after that, but we snaked them out like the Secret Service so we could record this for you, and it's been a great couple days so far, just being around a lot of people like us that want to share like minds and have great ideas.
Yeah, Steve, why don't you tell me what your highlights have been so far?
Okay, well, before I do, I just want to say that because you're listening to this show brought to you by ChrisKresser.com, if you go to the Big Red Box, there's an email series that Chris has put together called Beyond Paleo. Now, Beyond Paleo is going to cover all different ideas that Chris has done a lot of research on over the years, and they're going to give you benefits, things like reducing your fat mass, giving you more energy, restoring your gut health, and just leading a generally more happy and healthier life. So if you're listening to the show, you want to learn about things like that, I'd suggest you go to the Big Red Box and put your name and email in there, and Chris will start spitting some knowledge your way. So back to what I've loved so far, other than the atmosphere, I think just, man, Rob Wolf's talk really blew me away kind of on his vision scale. And then I also like the Q&A that Rob and Mark Sisson did today to kind of get a little more informal with their lives, and kind of they sort of brought a level of just kind of chillness, like don't take everything so serious. So I thought that was good.
Mm-hmm. I unfortunately missed that because I was preparing a little bit for my talk, and I went to bed really late last night, so I didn't feel like getting up and coming for that. We were out at this really great sustainable farm dinner last night. It was put on by Diana Rogers, and it was an amazing experience. It was definitely one of my highlights at AHS. It was on her land. They have 20 acres, and the dinner was going to be outside, but as you know, there was a rainstorm last night.
Yeah.
So they moved it inside of the barn, which is really fun, and there were goats in there, and
nice.
And you know, we kind of just milled around at first, and we had some hors d'oeuvres and some organically grown wines from different, you know, from all over the world, some local and some from other countries. And all of the food was, you know, organically and sustainably grown, a lot of it local, and it was catered by this really amazing catering company that is not only thinking about the food and, you know, what the food's like, that it's grown organically and sustainably, but everything else that they do, they recycle and compost, and they're not generating a lot of trash, and they're thinking about the sustainability of the event from the start to finish, not even just with the food. And there was a band, some really good music, and there was a raffle drawing. It was a lot of fun. Got a chance to talk to a lot of people and just kind of have a really fun time. So that was a highlight for me, but we didn't get back till pretty late. So
Chris isn't just worn out because he was partying all night. No, it was for a good cause, right?
Yeah. There was a raffle that generated some money, and then the tickets also generate. You know, there was some charity. Some of that money went to charity. I'm not sure what it is. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
But it was a great event, and so as much as I would have liked to see Rob and Mark do a Q&A, it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, no big deal. I will say on the food front, AHS has given us some lunches, and today I saw the biggest bowl of guacamole I've ever seen. It was probably like a 5 liter bowl of it.
The food's been amazing, actually. I mean, all the meals that they've served have been really good. And I actually appreciate that I haven't been forced onto a low carb diet, which sometimes happens at these things, you know, where it's just like meat and salad and vegetables. And
Well, speaking of low carb, was a reason why you're so wore out because you felt the need to blog last night before you went to bed?
I didn't do it last night. That's one of the things I did this morning, actually, when I woke up. I mean, the thing about me is it's problematic with going to bed late is I wake up pretty much at the same time regardless of when I go to bed. So if I go to bed at 2, I'm still waking up at 6, and that means I get, you know, only a few hours of sleep. But today I actually managed to sleep in until 7:30, which is a miracle for me. That's like one of the latest sleep-ins I've ever had in 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know for most people that's still getting up early, but yeah, there. You're, I think, getting to the starch debate.
I was hinting towards it.
So we had yesterday, there was one of the panels I was on, I forget the exact name, but it was is starch safe? And it was moderated, I think that it was conceived of by Jimmy Moore, and he was the moderator. And then there were four people on the panel. It was myself, Paul Jaminet on the pro safe starch side, and then it was Dr. Kate Shanahan and Dr. Ron Rosedale on the anti-starch side, or should I say, Dr. Rosedale feels like no amount of glucose is safe for anybody, and he actually said this exact quote, that we're all diabetic. And Dr. Shanahan, I'm a little less clear actually on what her position is, but essentially what I got out of her argument was that glucose is toxic because it raises insulin, but most people can tolerate between 20 and 70 grams of carbohydrates a day. Is that what you got out of her position?
Yeah, it seemed like she had used that range of low carbohydrate diet because everyone has a different definition of what is low carb and what's very low carb, but she was using a 20 to 70 gram range effectively, she said, in her clinic for her patients, and she hadn't seen some of the problems that you and Paul had mentioned.
So what do you think about that panel, Steve?
Well, as a non-expert in starch and just sitting in the audience, I've been to a lot of conferences, and sometimes there's a hesitancy from an expert to sit on a panel like that and sit in the fire and actually speak their minds. So as someone in the audience, I was very impressed not only about Chris's ability to handle some sort of aggressive points of view, but I was happy that all the experts said their piece and they didn't all decide in the end that they were, you know, awesome friends and they're going to ride off into Never Never Land. So I'm glad that the debate raged on. I think it might have got a little heated at some points, but hopefully everyone still respects each other.
Yeah, I mean, it was civil. For anyone who wasn't there, there were no chairs thrown, Jerry Springer style or anything like that. it was, I think there was a little bit of tension here and there. From my perspective, it was a little bit frustrating at times because we didn't have a chance to respond to comments that were made. It was just kind of, we just went down the line and each person got to say their piece and then it went back to the start and there wasn't really much of a dialogue, which I think would have been helpful in terms of clarifying certain, in my mind, misinterpretations that were made, and perhaps the other side felt the same way. So, but it was a good exercise. I maybe some people that were on the fence had, you know, changed their mind one way or another due to what was what the panelists presented, and if that's the case, then that's good. But since I already wrote a post about that, summarizing my argument, maybe we should talk about a few other highlights.
Well, let's talk about our friend Master Jay, because he dropped a pretty hot presentation on the fact that we might actually all have the ability to digest carbohydrates, and I thought there was some really cool info on that.
Yeah, it was ironic, actually, the timing of that, because Chris's talk was right before the starch panel, and unbeknownst to me, he proceeded to start. His first four or five slides were basically, this is something I mentioned in the web article, is that when you look at primates, you see that non-human primates like chimpanzees have very few copies of the gene that codes for salivary amylase, which is an enzyme amylase in the saliva that helps to break down the complex sugars and starch. And then you look at graph of humans, and you see that we have many, many, many more salivary copies of the gene that codes for salivary amylase. So that, of course, implies that we're genetically adapted to digest starch and break it down, utilize it. And earlier in the conference, Professor Dan Lieberman, who's an anthropologist, I think, here at Harvard, he kicked off the symposium, and he discussed the role that starch plays in human evolution. It was a really important food for when we came out of the trees, so to speak, onto the grasslands. It gave us an alternative to fruit and insects, and allowed us to thrive in environments that would have otherwise been pretty marginal for us. So Chris talked about that, and what's interesting about that is that different populations have different levels of those different levels of those salivary amylase genes. So it implies two things. Number one, since all humans have those genes, all humans should theoretically be able to tolerate some, or at least are genetically adapted to tolerate some starch, barring any, you know, metabolic abnormalities. And the second thing that it implies is that, genetically speaking, some of us might be more able to digest starch than others, or we might do better than others. And I think that does explain some of the difference that individual differences that people observe, and cultural differences in their ability to break down starch.
Yeah, I thought one of the coolest graphs that I've seen of all the presentations I've seen was one of his, where he showed the copies of the genetic amylases, and he showed that in populations that had been eating a higher starch diet over the long term, you could actually see genetic changes, that they were selecting for more amylase receptors or genetic mutations. I'm probably saying the wrong word there. But I just thought that was a really cool display of kind of some genetics at work there.
Yeah. Another really important part of Chris's talk that I'm not sure came across as... well, you know, Chris is an extremely smart guy, and he's very talented at synthesizing information and communicating it clearly to an audience that might not have a scientific background. That said, some of the stuff he was talking about was pretty complex, and I think, you know, some people need to hear that more than once to understandably for it to really sink in. But it was really relevant in terms of the starch debate, and I wanted to be able to bring that into the discussion, but we just didn't have time to get into it on that kind of micro level. But essentially what Chris was saying, and this is what's so important, is one of the arguments the anti-starch brigade uses against starch and glucose in general is that it raises insulin and that it causes the formation of advanced glycation end products, AGEs. And AGEs are associated with aging. Therefore, the argument goes, glucose and starch reduce longevity. So that, you know, makes sense on a mechanistic perspective when you say it that way, but there are a few problems with that argument. Number one, and this is what Chris pointed out, is that in vivo, meaning in the body, glucose contributes very little directly to advanced glycation end product formation. It's actually dicarbonyls like methyl glyoxide that play a much bigger role in the formation of AGEs than glucose does directly. That may be different in people who have really chronically elevated levels of glucose, but in a normal physiological response, glucose directly does not play a big role in the formation of AGEs. And secondly, there's three steps involved in the formation of an advanced glycation end product. There's first the formation of a shift base, then the formation of an amidori product, and then finally the formation of an advanced glycation end product. And the first two of those three steps are reversible. And it's a concentration-dependent process, which means that if your blood sugar is over a certain threshold, the body will start that process of forming a shift base and then an amidori product after that. But if the glucose level drops down again, then that process will reverse, and an AGE will not be formed. And so the significance of this in terms of the glucose and starch argument is that, you know, that the Dr. Rosedale and other people say that glucose spikes and insulin spikes are so harmful because of this AGE formation. But the fact is, if you eat some starch and your blood sugar goes up and your insulin goes up as a result for a short time, which is a completely normal physiological response, that's the way our bodies are designed. The insulin is there to put the glucose into the cells where it belongs. That's not a problem in terms of AGE formation because, as I said, the glucose levels would have to be elevated consistently for a long period of time for those AGEs to form irreversibly. So Chris didn't talk about that as much as he talked about the fact that dicarbonyls like methylglyoxal are way more responsible for AGE formation. So his talk was quite technical, but what he was really saying was that, yes, starch is safe for most people, and by the way, glucose is not the main problem in terms of AGE formation, and therefore is not probably a significant contributor to aging in most people.
Great summary, and I'll probably need to listen to the summary again and the talk a few times because there were so many technical diagrams in that talk that my head hurt. Well, let's move on to the man's office that we're in, where he wasn't talking as much about carbohydrate. He was talking more about nutrients. And what is now being referred to as the Kraken Index of Nutrients.
Yeah, the Kraken score or the Kraken Index. So, I mean, as you would expect, Matt did another great job busting down some popular myths and shedding some light on the debate. So, in my sense, I think different people had different interpretations of his talk and came away with different things. But my sense of what that talk was about showing how ridiculous some of the nutrient indexes are and how much they are driven by agenda rather than evidence. And a really good example of that would be the ANDI score, which some of you might be familiar with, ANDI. This is like if any of you have ever been to Whole Foods and you walk in and you wander around the aisles there, you'll see that different foods have been given this ANDI score, and it's a scale of 0 to 1,000. And the food on the top of the list is kale at 1,000. And then there are a bunch of other, you know, leafy green vegetables and other vegetables and fruits as you go down the list. And you don't find an animal product until 37 on the ANDI score out of 1,000. And that's boneless, skinless chicken breast. So obviously, when you see that nutrient density score and you know anything about the nutrient density of food and animal products and especially organ meats, you there's a red flag going up right there, right? That you might wonder, what are the criteria they're using to make this nutrient score? So Matt revealed what those criteria are, and they're exotic markers like lycopene, antioxidants that have not really been proven necessarily to have a beneficial effect, and they're not essential, meaning that they're not essential nutrients, meaning that the body can function without them. They're not established in the scientific literature as being particularly crucial for health. It's almost as if they picked the nutrients, you know, that they backed into it. They picked the nutrients that would make kale and all of the vegetables and fruits be highest on the list, and they completely ignored essential nutrients like some of the longer chain fatty acids and some of the fat soluble vitamins and things that can only be found in animal foods so that they would be low on the list. So what Matt did is he created the Kraken score, which he didn't that wasn't the term that he used, but that's what people started calling it afterwards. And incidentally, I think Ned Koch, who's a statistician and a really smart guy, his blog is Health Correlator, and he's here. He was on one of the panels I was on. He reviewed Matt's work, and he said that it was a PhD's worth of work, and Matt did it in 6 days. In this office, in the cracking cave that we're in right now.
An IV full of coffee.
So it was a tremendous amount of work. I mean, you should have seen these spreadsheets he was presenting, and he had to correct for something. Like, for example, a lot of the data, he was using the USDA database that's publicly available, but, you know, different foods had different measurements, so he had to correct for that and create a standardized measurement system, and there was a lot of statistical work to be done there, and just a lot of work in general. So it was a really, really important contribution. So he ranked foods according, which makes a lot more sense in my mind, according to nutrients that we actually know are essential. And essential means that in this context that I've spoken about before, in the context of essential fatty acids, are things that we need to eat from the diet because the body cannot make them on its own. So these were amino acids and some of the fat-soluble vitamins and then minerals, and then also, well, he did a provisional thing with fatty acids where he used the current accepted essential fatty acids, which are linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid, and then provisionally essential fatty acids. A lot of researchers and people, including me, believe that the longer chain omega-3 fats like EPA and DHA are essential. So he incorporated both. And then he recalculated the scores, and wouldn't you know it, you know, they changed quite a bit. And it doesn't mean that kale and blueberries and some of the fruits and vegetables that were high on the Andy score weren't high in terms of nutrient density on this score. Many of them were very high. Kale is an incredibly nutrient-dense vegetable and really great from just about any perspective you look at it from. But animal foods, especially organ meats, ended up being much higher on the list. And in fact, as I've often said, liver and other organ meats were higher than many of the vegetables in terms of their nutrient density. One of the big favorites in the room was that of all pork products, bacon scored highest in terms of nutrient density. That a lot of people got a kick out of that.
That vindicated my bacon habit, so I'm pretty happy about that.
I'll point out on a couple. So the first, I got here on Wednesday night, and Rob called me up and said, come for breakfast tomorrow at the Kraken's house. So I went over there in the morning. It was Rob, John Welburn, Kraken, and myself, and I walked in. And on the table, there was a plate of bacon, no joke, at least 6 inches high. Three different types of bacon, crispy bacon, softer bacon, dip bacon from here, bacon from there. And then there was another plate of sausages, chorizo, bratwurst, can't remember the other one, it was coiled up. I think if any of you follow me on Twitter, I think, or Rob or Matt, there were some pictures up there. And then duck eggs that were just enormous, and some slow-cooked sweet potatoes that he had made before. And I don't think I ate another meal until like 8 o'clock that night. I was so full when I left there. And those guys can put it away, let me tell you.
Yeah, John Wilburn's a big dude.
I feel like a 5-year-old child standing next to that guy, and I'm not that small.
Let's move on to another talk that just took place, probably fresh in your mind, the talk from Stephen Guiney. I thought it was pretty informative as far as from your, you know, he obviously thanked you for helping him with the talk, and I thought it was really cool just to show the different relationships between obesity and the gut flora. And I also thought there were some great little nuggets in there about antibiotic use for kids and what that does to raise risk for inflammatory bowel disease and possibly obesity.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I always love Stefan's talks too and his work in general, as I'm sure you know. So Stefan split his presentation into two parts. And in the first part, he talked about the relationship between poor digestive function, particularly intestinal permeability and dysregulated gut flora and metabolic syndrome. And the second half, I think, was even more interesting from a certain perspective, just because we've heard a lot about, or at least some people have heard a lot about the relationship between the gut and metabolic health. But the second part was what Stefan and I talked a lot about before the, you know, as we were coming up to AHS, which was that there's a lot of interesting research showing how much psychosocial stress can impair gut function and how much of a contributor that might be to metabolic health. And he presented some really interesting research showing that psychosocial stress is, you know, can cause gut permeability, which I've written about before when we talked about the gut-brain axis. And then he presented some data suggesting that particularly workplace stress is associated with a higher incidence of the metabolic syndrome. So I think he did a great job, and that was definitely a highlight of the conference for me.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really a good one to review in the future. Like you said, he presented a lot of research that hadn't been synthesized before. Mm-hmm. So, well, let's talk about Rob's talk, because he sort of shook the conference with his visionary thinking and talking about some studies that are underway right now with the paleo mm-hmm. diet.
Yeah, I mean, Rob, if you never had a chance to see Rob speak, I hope you get to sometime. He's a fantastic speaker. He really holds the room, and he's inspirational, and you know, you just get a sense of electricity in the room when he's talking. And you know, he's been there, done that with talking about the specifics of a paleo diet. He wrote a book on it. He has a podcast. I think he's quite understandably tired of, you know, giving a presentation about the paleo diet or carbs or whatever. So lately, Rob's been talking a lot more about policy and how to move this movement out onto a much broader scale and how to affect a wider range of people. And specifically, we are in a really, really dire situation with our healthcare system right now. And I know that's not news to people, but in the next 20 years, our country is already in hideous amount of debt. And by what was the year on the slide? Do you remember?
It was 2030.
The projection at current rates of growth in healthcare expenses is that healthcare alone will account for 300% of GDP. So that is a very sobering number, and it essentially means that healthcare is going to bankrupt our country three times over, and something has to be done about it. And what we've been doing so far is clearly not working, because it just keeps going up. And of that you know, how many billions and billions and trillions actually of dollars that will be spent on healthcare, a significant portion of that is diabetes and diabetes related complications. I don't remember the exact number. It might have been as high as 75%. You remember?
Wow. No, I don't remember, but
yeah, essentially diabetes and diabetes related complications, which of course include cardiovascular disease and, you know, several other things that kill us in large numbers every year, accounts for 75% or more of healthcare expense. And diabetes is a completely preventable disease. It's highly, highly mediated by lifestyle factors. It's a lifestyle disease. You know, you're not born with diabetes. You're born with a susceptibility. And we're talking about type 2 diabetes here, not type 1 diabetes, which does have a strong genetic predisposition. But even then, you're not born with type, you know, with automatically having that without a doubt, without the influence of any environmental triggers. So Rob, you know, he basically feels like waiting around for public policymakers to figure this out is just it's not going to happen. And I would have to agree with him there. And he's thinking about other models that might be really effective, like public-private partnerships and even just exclusively private efforts. And he shared the results of one of those in Nevada. It was one group was the university, UNLV Police Department. Is that right?
Police or fire, one of the two.
Police or fire department. And then he hooked up with another group, police department in Reno. And just by, you know, testing some basic biomarkers that we're all familiar with, fasting glucose, cholesterol, hemoglobin A1C, and then intervening with a lowish carb. First of all, I think the first thing was just a low carb diet, and then they moved to a more paleo type of diet. And
yeah,
the changes that they saw were just absolutely remarkable. And the return on investment was remarkable. It was like a 20 to 1 return on investment or something like that.
Yeah, if I was a VC, I'd be cashing in on that.
Yeah, it was just and the you know the time in which it happened, and you could see the biomarkers just going down dramatically, and there was no other, there's no drugs that are known that can do, you know, that can lead to that kind of change that quickly and that sustainably. So it's really exciting. I hope we can bring more of that kind of stuff in, and it's great to see Rob, you know, putting it out there.
Yeah, I was particularly inspired, and just for, I thought it was really ingenious to just boil it down to something that I think every American can really think about hard every night when they go to bed, which is dollars and cents. And he's boiling this down to, look, it's gotten so bad that it's now a dollars and cents problem. If we want our country to stay the way it is, if we want to have something for our kids, then we have to make a change.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's a really dire circumstance. It's, you know, a lot of other things are getting cheaper with technological innovation, but healthcare just keeps getting more expensive. And in fact, that was one of his main points. So
yeah, if we could show you this really cool graph. He had some great graphs about Moore's Law and some awful classes that I took in college about transistors and how they double over
time.
That's
right, Mr. Electrical Engineer.
Yeah, that's kind of burned in my retinas a long time ago. But yeah, I think the summary was, let's make Moore's Law happen in the healthcare world.
Yeah.
Well, I know we're both kind of running out on fumes here. Let's wrap this up by having you give us like 2-minute overview. What should we take away from your iron presentation?
Yeah, so my iron presentation was about the effects of iron overload primarily on metabolic health. And the takeaway is that a lot of people know that hemochromatosis, which is a genetic condition that causes excess iron storage, is harmful. But what a lot of people don't know is that even mild iron overload, and in fact high normal levels of iron, can cause metabolic, cardiovascular, and endocrine problems. So I presented a lot of research suggesting that, both epidemiological studies showing correlations between iron overload and mild iron overload with a number of different diseases. And then I showed some studies that indicate that restoring iron levels to normal can reverse those conditions, which is another piece of evidence that makes it more likely that there's actually a causal relationship between those iron overload and disease. And then I talked about how to test for iron overload and how to treat it. And fortunately, the Ancestral Health Foundation is going to make all of these presentations available. So if you'd like to, and if you're interested in this topic, at some point you'll be able to watch my presentation. I just want to say also, before we finish up, that on a personal note, the best part about these conferences, and this is true for PaleoFX earlier, and it's definitely true for this one, is getting a chance to meet people in person that I've had a lot of contact with, you know, over the internet and the phone up until now. Like you two guys, for example, Steve and Jordan, my faithful podcast producers, who do just an incredible amount of work to make this show possible. It was really a great opportunity to meet you both in person. Been a real pleasure. And believe it or not, I hadn't met Stefan Guillenet or Matt Lalonde in person, or Chris Masterjohn. I've talked to them all, you know, at least Stefan and Matt on the phone several times. I trade emails with them sometimes several times a week, and I still hadn't even had a chance to meet them in person. And what's amazing about it is it feels like we're old friends, like with Stefan, and you know, especially because we had a lot of contact on the phone. It was just, you know, we just picked up, kind of like felt like we were old friends and hadn't seen each other for a while. So then I've gotten a chance to meet several patients that I treat long distance that I hadn't met in person, and get to know them a little bit better. And then just meeting lots of readers and listeners of the podcast and the blog has been great. It just it makes it that much more gratifying and rewarding for me. And so I've really only seen about 30% of the presentations since I've been here, because I've been so busy socializing and talking to people, and that's been the best part about it for me.
Yeah, when you get the smartest guys in the room and you get a bunch of like-minded people, like you said, it's one thing to be friends on the internet, but when you bring the human element into it and you get to interact with people that you really admire, you know, you like, and you call a friend, it's really cool to shake their hand and hang out. So definitely like these conferences. I'll be going to them in the future for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's if any of you are thinking about doing it next year, make sure to sign up in advance. There are a lot of people, actually, that I met at the party last night, because the party wasn't just people from AHS. It was other people from the surrounding community that are interested in this stuff. And a lot of them really wanted to come to the AHS, but by the time they got around to checking for tickets, there weren't any left. So I don't know where it's going to be next year. Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't heard any rumors yet.
Yeah, so, but when the tickets do go on sale, you know, it's an amazing experience. It's really inspiring to be around such a committed, passionate group of people who share a lot of values. And I've had a great time. I really look forward to it. And I really miss Sylvie. I did a FaceTime with her this morning, and it was so hard. I haven't been away from her for this long. And Elan, my wife, said that she kind of took her first step yesterday, which I was really sad to miss, but apparently it was a preliminary step because she's not walking yet, but
she's gonna wait for daddy.
Yeah,
we gotta get you home.
Like, put her down. Wait. So I look forward to getting home, and I miss her, but it's been a fantastic experience, and I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful time, and I appreciate meeting everybody that I talked to. I know there was a lot of listeners that also said hello to me, so
yeah.
Definitely appreciate you guys listening to the podcast, talking with us, submitting your ideas and everything, because that's what helps make this show tick.
One last thing I want to say is a huge thank you to the organizers. This conference I've never been to a conference that was just so smooth before. It just went off without a hitch, and I don't know exact everyone that was involved by name. I know Aaron and Beth and Carlos and several other people, Kathleen, have just worked their butts off for a long time to make this happen, and I've been so impressed with the way they pulled it off. It's just been really seamless, and that's, you know, when you don't notice anything, that's when it's just really excellent planning.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of people here, so.
Yeah, it's a big, I don't know, you know, there are 400 or 500 people in the room during the talk, so it's pretty remarkable.
Yep. Huge thanks to them, and I know they have a lot of volunteers that will go unnamed, yeah. that do a lot of work in the background to make sure that the food was ready, that the name tags were out, and that the presenters get to where they need to go.
Huge thank you for all the support that you all offered me since I've been here. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, this is coming to you again live from the Kraken Cave here at Harvard. I actually feel a little smarter just sitting in the room here.
Matt, we're staring at Matt's standing desk here with his laptop up on the wall, and his pictures hanging, lots of books on the bookshelf, and yeah, you can feel the intelligence pouring out of here.
Yep. Well, we want to thank you for listening today. It's been another great episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. If you liked what you heard, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. That's really key for us to get more traffic, to spread this radio show to other people that could really use this help, and again, help lower our the money we're spending on healthcare. So let's tie it all together and spread the show, and keep sending us your questions to chriscresser.com, and we'll talk to you then.